More than 300,000 Americans have died from COVID-19 so far. What role can images of this moment play in keeping others safe?
Elected officials made decisions that prolonged or increased the suffering of people. And for us not to see images of the suffering that those decisions caused does a disservice to the victims of this disease, I believe.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today in the Takeaway for Tuesday, December 15th, images of a pandemic and how to use them for the public good. Also on the show, how state and local governments are and should communicate with Americans about the rollout of the vaccine.
We haven't received any word yet on who will be the first ones to receive the vaccine or how it will be distributed.
I am currently a teacher, so it looks like I will be in the category 1B to get the vaccine.
By now, many of us have heard the basic recommendations for stopping the spread of the coronavirus. Wash your hands, wear a mask, and stay 6 feet away from others. These basic recommendations have become staples of public service announcements from national and state governments, as well as healthcare companies.
I wear a mask because I can't, but my baby can't. Do it for their futures.
Even though there is so much against us.
You will see me choose to protect myself and my community from the coronavirus by wearing a face covering.
Because it's going to take all of us thinking about one another.
And even with my face covered, you will see me.
But as COVID-19 continues to spike through the winter, my next guest says these tame ads aren't doing enough. And she says that public service announcements about the virus need to be more graphic in depicting the reality of the coronavirus and maybe even instill some fear in us. She wrote about this in an op-ed last week in the New York Times. Elizabeth Rosenthal is the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News, a former emergency room physician and author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Elizabeth, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Good to be back, Tanzina.
You wrote a piece in the New York Times where you make the case for trying fear-based messaging around COVID-19. Why do you think that that's the case, and what do you mean?
Well, first of all, I don't think fear is the right word. I mean, in the social sciences, they talk about these ads as fear-based, but I think of them as reality-based ads. And the reason I say this is because I look at all these PSAs, the public service ads, and or announcements, and they're all kind of, you said tame, I kind of think of them as lame. They're exhortational. They're cute. They're the kind of ads I usually associate with, like, you know, pooper scooper or don't spread your legs on the subway. But, you know, we have a serious pandemic going. And I think the reality of getting a bad case of COVID is ugly. It's scary. And people should be reacting to that. And when people tell me, oh, well, studies are mixed on whether fear-based ads work, I say, look, we've been trying these cute ads for 8 months now, and it's not working in many parts of the country. So time to step up our game or to change our strategy.
One of the things you talk about in your piece is the use of ventilators and how I think, and we've been, you know, in preparing for this conversation, we on the show, we're talking a little bit about how Americans really understand a ventilator, what the process is like and what it's really like. And tell us a little bit about what it's really like. And do you think showing something like that to Americans would change their minds?
Well, it's hard to watch is the problem. And, you know, in this day and age of, you know, kind of, you know, trigger warnings, it's ugly. It's hard for children. You kind of don't want children to see it, but it is the reality. It's, you know, when I was a medical resident and we had to put people on ventilators, we kind of, you know, in the kind of black humor of residency, we called it torturing people. Not because it isn't a good thing. If you're likely to need it and if it will help, it's great. They're fabulous technology, but it's really uncomfortable. You can't talk. You've got a tube down your throat. You're gagging. You're fighting the ventilator. And, you know, part of the problem is many people know people now who've had mild cases of COVID, but the people who've had the bad cases are in intensive care units or they're isolated or in their homes because they're too out of breath to go out. And we don't see enough of those people. There's, to me, this odd dichotomy. We see those bad cases on the news on some stations, but we don't see them in public service ads. So the public service ads are kind of playing nice and exhortational, you know, do it for your neighbor. And in TV, we're showing, wow, this can be really bad. But we've got to kind of merge those two thoughts.
You mentioned also in your piece, and I remember a lot of these ads when I was a kid, the stop smoking adverts that and messages that many of us saw as children that were pretty graphic. It showed deformed faces and people who had lost parts of their bodies as a result of smoking. That did not prevent a lot of people from smoking. It was a different time, a different era, but I think that they're, personally, I think that they're pretty effective as a former smoker myself. Is that the tack that you would take with these ads?
As of now, yes. I might not have said so 7-8 months ago, but I, like you, am from New York. I know how bad it was there. And, you know, you always hope that people will listen to do the right thing. But in many parts of the country, they're not. And the smoking ads, sure, not everyone stopped smoking, but between 1967 and 1970, when there was a very concerted campaign on TV at the time, smoking rates dropped by about 5%. And where they've been tried for smoking, they're very effective. Now, you know, you can find studies showing that fear-based ads are mostly effective for one-time interventions rather than prolonged behavior. Yes, that's true. But I would say, and as a former smoker, you know, stopping smoking is really, really hard. So if an ad can make people stop smoking, it should be able to make people, like, just put on a face mask for, you know, the next 6 months while the vaccine kind of rolls out.
In theory, yes. And yet there are, you know, we've had very mixed messaging from the federal government on down, particularly at the federal government, in terms of the politicization of this virus, in terms of how masks themselves have become a political statement. Is it too late, Elizabeth, to try to come out with a new approach at this point, given where we are today?
I don't think so. And here I invoke, you know, my hero in this, Dr. Fauci. You know, it's not too late. We can still do a lot. I mean, certainly the people who are saying this is a hoax, even as they're, you know, going into the ICU, I couldn't have COVID. You're never going to convince them. But I think there's a lot of the country that's kind of confused, in part because they've heard this mixed messaging from the White House and from some of the public service, public health people, in part because it's a new virus. We've been learning things about it over the last 8 months. And at the beginning, it didn't seem like masks made much of a difference. But very early on, we knew they did. So I think people are a little confused. There's a big part of the population that you could reach. And the thing is, if we go from 50% masking to 70% masking in a community, that will make a big difference in spread. If we go from 50% to 90%, that would make a huge difference. So I think, yes, sure, there are some people you're never going to convince. There are some people that are going to smoke until they get lung cancer. But there are a whole lot of people out there I think we can still reach with a new kind of public service announcement.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the memes that we're even seeing. I saw something, and even some journalism that's coming out that really sort of speaks to the opposite of what you're saying, which is let's meet people where they are. For example, if we know people aren't going to wear masks and we know they're not going to not travel for the holidays, then let's give them tips on how to do it as safely as possible. I have very mixed feelings about that. I think that that's somewhat irresponsible, but at the same time, you have people that say, look, you've got to meet people where they are, and we have to be realistic about what Americans are willing and not willing to do. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think it has to be either or. I don't object to some PSAs being kind of exhortational and saying to a 25-year-old who's going to fly, you know, this is the way to do it safely, or quarantine before you see your grandmother. I think you need that information too. But I do think you also need to show people what it looks like to be a COVID long hauler, what it looks like to be on a ventilator. I think almost the scarier part, because when you're on a ventilator, you're usually very sedated, is when you're lying in bed in an ICU, not quite needing a ventilator, but watching those oxygen saturation numbers rise and dip above your head, thinking, oh my gosh, where is this headed? I mean, that is terrifying. And, you know, I have a friend who's an infectious disease doctor at Tampa General. And she said, you know, a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, I have a cousin who had it. It's not so bad. You know, where masking is not prevalent at the moment. And yes, for many people, it will not be so bad. My son had COVID. He had a mild case. My mother had COVID. She died from it. So, you know, we have to express the range of possibilities and make it clear to people that you don't know, even if you're 25, whether you're going to have a really bad case or a mild case. And, you know, one of the PSAs I'd like to see is from an NFL football player who has a long haul COVID syndrome, who is missing the season, you know, is short of breath when he, a really fit person previously, has to climb up the stairs. I mean, that's powerful.
What about in the world of journalism, Elizabeth, the world that you and I both are deeply familiar and committed to? Do journalists need to be more direct about the effects of particularly severe cases of COVID-19, and also just how they talk about it and how they we're going to have a conversation a little bit on the show about the images that they use? Where would you say, quote unquote, the media is on this so far?
Well, it's a little bit all over the map. I think the media has tried to show how bad COVID can get. I mean, we've certainly seen scenes within ICUs. We've had doctors and nurses in tears because they're trying to do their best. They're exhausted. You know, so we do see, particularly on television, on cable, on the internet, memes of how bad it can get. But, you know, the media in particular and how Americans digest the media at the moment is so affiliated with your political party. So those messages may not get to people who are looking primarily at the more right-leaning media who've kind of downplayed COVID or even said it's a hoax. So I think the media has tried its best. I mean, some of it is genuinely hard because it's hard to get reporters into an ICU, and you probably don't want them there kind of interfering with the desperate work that's being done. So, you know, I'm, you know, it's funny. One little thing we talked about is the photo that went with my story in the New York Times, my op-ed about how we have to scare people a little bit more. And again, it's reality show people, not scare people, was of an empty stretcher. I was like, that's a weird choice. Why don't we put someone on a vent in that time slot? So I think the media has tried its best and has done a pretty good job. But, you know, our electorate, our country is very polarized in what kind of media it chooses to believe. So
Elizabeth Rosenthal is editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jancina.
Photojournalists documenting COVID-19 on the front lines have been, for many of us, our window into the suffering, grief, and empathy of this past year. Photographs have also played an important role in combating rampant misinformation about the coronavirus. As we continue to look at the role of imagery in communicating about this pandemic, we're turning to the journalistic choices behind these types of images. And for that, I'm joined by Corinne Perkins, North American editor for Reuters Pictures. Corinne, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Also with us is Victor Blue, a freelance photographer who's been covering the coronavirus pandemic for The New York Times. Victor, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Victor, let's start with you. You have been covering the pandemic since the beginning. You've captured images that have been inside hospitals, and we've seen some of these photos. And I have to say, Part of the reason why we're doing this is because I don't know if a lot of people really see what you see. There are photos that you have here of a couple that is absolutely devastated, wearing masks and crying in what appears to be an elevator. And there's another photo you have of presumably a healthcare worker, head to toe in PPE, walking through what appears to be a morgue. Tell us about your experience as a photographer in COVID-19.
Well, I was very fortunate to be assigned by the New York Times to work with the amazing reporter Sherry Fink to cover the pandemic from inside the hospitals in New York City. We photographed and reported from the ICUs and COVID wards of a handful of hospitals in the city. And we were able to witness the devastation that the virus was wreaking firsthand. So, yeah, those two pictures that you mentioned, especially the one of the couple in the elevator and then the same couple over the bedside of an ICU ward, that's Eliana Rendon and her husband, Edelson. She is the granddaughter of Carmen Torres, who succumbed to the virus in mid-April. And her extended family, who were spread out across the United States and Colombia, agreed to have us document the withdrawal of life support for her grandmother, Carmen Torres, at North Shore Hospital in Queens. The other image that you were referring to is of a guy named Alexis, who's a patient transport worker at the Brooklyn Hospital Center. And as a picture of one of the morgue trucks, inside one of the morgue trucks that had become kind of ubiquitous in the city during the pandemic. They were parked outside the hospitals to deal with the overflow of corpses who were dying inside the hospitals.
Victor, have readers responded to your images?
Yes, certainly they have. It's been gratifying to see the response from readers of the newspaper. We've had, reader comments and emails to me and on the story on the website as well. Folks who, maybe didn't believe so much, or to whom the devastation of the pandemic of COVID-19 had been remote, but seeing the pain and the sacrifice of individual families of people with names. People with, we saw their faces, their home life changed, I think, the remove that people felt from what was happening.
Corinne, there was a Reuters photograph that similarly captured the attention of many of us. And it was of a man being comforted by a doctor wearing full PPE, presumably in his last moments. As an editor, as a photo editor, Corinne, how do you make decisions about which photos run during this time?
I think it's about making sure that we have a variety of images that hit people and present the visual evidence of what's happening, so that there is that undeniability of what's going on. And we wanted to really make sure that things were as relatable as possible. So looking for those very human moments of connections, the embraces, the looking through the windows at your loved ones, the last moments, the last rites and things like that as well. We've really tried to show a variety of hospitals. We weren't able to get into as many of the New York hospitals, so we had to really look at different ways of presenting what was going on in New York in a different way. So we were looking at those mobile morgues that Victor mentioned, the funeral homes that were really inundated with bodies in Harlem, the drone images of Heart Island as there was mass burials during the peak of the crisis in New York, and then looking at different hospitals across the country, so rural Kansas to downtown Houston to the south side of Chicago, so making sure that we have a timeline of where the virus is hitting the worst and that we're presenting those moments to readers and making sure that they're aware of what's going on.
And Corinne, Reuters photographs can appear in many publications across the world. Do you ever look at the photographs that you receive and think this might be too much?
With this one, our tolerance for what has been too much has grown, I think, as there's still been people denying the virus. And we were talking with one of the doctors in Houston who has afforded us a lot of access to his hospital down there, and asked him what is going to turn the views of the people who are still denying it. And he said, we need to get more graphic images out there of what's happening in the last moments of people's lives before they die from this virus. So the last time we went in, that's what we presented, the sort of CPR on a patient and his body being put into a body bag, and those really sort of more graphic final moments. Whereas at the beginning of the pandemic, we probably wouldn't have shown those ones, although we did have pictures of inside the refrigerated trucks and things like that.
Victor, there are some people who say we shouldn't have images of people who are dying out of respect for their families. What do you think about that?
Well, I feel that along with many aspects of our society and of our culture that were kind of peeled back or laid bare, or we were forced to deal with during the pandemic, I think that this country's or our society's kind of complicated and sometimes dysfunctional relationship with death was one of those things. I think it's interesting that you hear some calls for less graphic imagery. I feel like those calls are oftentimes kind of politicized. And I don't personally believe that there's any dignity afforded to someone who has died because of circumstances outside their control, right? Because of political decisions by our leaders, not just at the federal level, but as well as our local and state level elected officials. Those folks made decisions that prolonged or increased the suffering of people. And for us not to see images of the suffering that those decisions caused, it does a disservice to the victims of this disease, I believe. I don't believe that showing them in their most difficult moments somehow diminishes their dignity in any way. And I think that, as Corinne said, you know, talking with the doctor in Houston, that these kind of images are the things that give people the information they need to understand what's happening to their communities, to their country, and to make the decisions they need to make politically, how they pull that lever, if they wear a mask or not, if they travel for Thanksgiving or Christmas, how they spend their money every day. You know, without these kind of pictures and without this documenting the severity of the pandemic, folks don't have the information they need to make the decisions they have to make every day.
Victor, a lot of the difficult images, I think, that people, Americans, you mentioned a really interesting point about Americans' relationship with understanding death. And I think a lot of the images that we see in the news about death are often not in the United States, mass death in particular. How, Victor, you've covered conflict and other difficult photographic moments. How does this one square with you in this moment, covering the coronavirus pandemic and massive amounts of death in the United States specifically?
Well, I think that it's true. You know, I think this country has had a double standard in what it's willing to look at. I don't know if that's, you know, specific to the United States or to any country, but it's much harder to look in your own backyard. It's much harder to see death and suffering when you can't look at it as someone else or an other that's removed from you. These are our communities, and it's hard to face up to the pain of what our communities are suffering. There's no question about it. So, and for me, covering the pandemic was in many ways, it was like going through the looking glass. In my everyday life, I was, you know, coming home, trying to stay safe, trying to keep my loved ones safe like everyone else. And then multiple times a week, I would enter the ICU wards and see what was happening inside them and see how people were suffering. And I felt compelled to get the message out. You know, Sherry Fink and I and our editors in the New York Times worked hard to get those stories out. But the strangest thing was doing it in my own community. I'm used to getting on an airplane and flying somewhere, a culture that I'm not a part of, that I'm not particularly conversant in, and trying to interpret it and trying to document it as honestly and accurately as possible. And now it was happening in my own city, in places I walk by every day. So it definitely had a through the looking glass kind of aspect to it. But I also tried to not adhere to that double standard. I tried to show what was happening in my own community and country the same way that I would in any other place in the world, and not pull my punches because I was afraid that it would upset people. If I'm not willing to do that in another country or about another culture, I shouldn't have been willing to do it here, and I was willing to do it.
Corinne Perkins is a North American editor for Reuters Picture, and Victor Blue is a freelance photographer who's been covering the coronavirus pandemic for the New York Times. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We've been talking about the role of images in PSAs and then in news outlets in understanding and combating COVID-19. So far, we've surpassed 300,000 deaths from the pandemic in the United States. And while a vaccine is now a reality, it's still a far-off one for most of us. In a few minutes, we'll turn to messaging from authorities about the COVID vaccine and what and how they need to communicate to the public about this massive undertaking. But first, we wanted to hear from you and whether you're planning to take the vaccine and how your state or local government is communicating with you about the vaccine's rollout.
Hi there, The Takeaway. My name is Katie and I am calling from San Diego, California. Absolutely 100%, I plan on getting it as soon as it's available. I am currently a teacher, so it looks like I will be in the category 1B to get the vaccine in my area. So my sleeve is rolled up and I'm ready to go.
Hi, my name is Salusha. I'm calling from Eugene, Oregon. And we received notice today that the vaccine has arrived in Oregon, but we haven't received any word yet on who will be the first ones to receive the vaccine or how it will be distributed. As far as taking the vaccine, I'm a little cautious about it and may wait and see, because this administration has bullied and pushed for this vaccine. And I wonder if any mistakes were made. I'm also concerned about the temperature that the vaccine needs to be held at. The bottom line is I'm not sure I'm going to take the vaccine right away. I'm going to wait and see what happens.
Hi, this is Doug calling from Orlando. I currently have COVID. I'm hoping to get over it soon. I would like to get a vaccination, but I'm wondering how it might interact with somebody who already has COVID, if it might cause a stronger reaction. You know, also, I'm assuming that I'm going to have some kind of a natural immunity just by having had the COVID. Other than that, I mean, here in Orlando, I think we're probably not going to get to regular people getting the vaccine for several months.
Hi, this is Brian Jones. I live outside of Austin in Dripping Springs. So far, I've heard that the hospitals, old folks' homes, 65-plus people, and marginalized people are going to get the shots first. After that, I do not know. We are in our early 50s, my wife and I, and haven't heard anything about our demographic. Perhaps this coming summer, let's hope. And absolutely, we are going to get that shot as soon as it comes out for us.
This is David from Highland Falls, New York. I'll take the vaccine as soon as it's offered, but I haven't seen any information about getting the vaccine in my town yet. I'm a healthcare provider. I'm an athletic trainer at a college. I know that the National Athletic Trainers Association is working to put us on the list with other healthcare professions. We've been working with our teams throughout the crisis. However, working for an athletic department and not a hospital, I'm just wondering how this will turn out. I'm hoping for the best.
Hi, this is Liz from Mountain View. Yes, my family and I will get the vaccine as soon as possible. I was a little worried about it, but Dr. Fauci says he believes in it and that the science is all there, so I'm going to go with that. I'm an educator, so I may be in one of the first few groups to receive it, and I'm very happy about that.
Hi, this is Quentin Hendricks. I'm calling from University City, and I will absolutely plan on getting the COVID vaccine as soon as it's available to me. I think it's the responsible thing to do, especially with so many people out there saying that they won't get it for various reasons, sometimes political.
I'm Robin from Fort Worth, Texas. I will get the COVID vaccine, but I'm glad I'm not in the group to get it first. I want to see what sort of reactions are reported. I'm a nurse,
So on paper, I could get it in the first group. However, I'm not practicing right now. And as for what my local government has said, I haven't paid attention to what Texas has said.
On Monday, Sandra Lindsay, a healthcare worker from Queens, New York, became the first person in the United States to receive the Pfizer and BioNTech coronavirus vaccine. She gave a statement while receiving the vaccine, wearing a mask and socially distanced from reporters.
I want to instill public confidence that the vaccine is safe. We're in a pandemic, and so we all need to do our part.
Recent surveys from Pew and Gallup show that about 60% of Americans say they are now willing to get the vaccine, but it will also take well-coordinated efforts by state and local governments to inform and incentivize the public to do so. Here to talk about all this is Frances Steed Sellers, a health reporter at The Washington Post. Frances, thanks for being with us.
Greetings. Great to be with you.
And Jessica Malati Rivera is a science communication lead at the COVID Tracking Project and an infectious disease epidemiologist. Jessica, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Frances, when we talk about vaccine messaging, what are some of the essential messages that need to be communicated to the public right now?
Well, I think what we're seeing is a delay in the kinds of essential messaging that people need to know about safety and efficacy. It's healthcare workers and doctors who've been watching the FDA reports and understanding the science behind this vaccine. And now we need to take it to a much broader segment of the population who are going to hear these messages from whatever kind of PSAs get put out, but also very significantly from people who already take the vaccine. So the healthcare workers now who are going through this vaccine actually play a very significant role going ahead in communicating about the vaccine. You're beginning to see that happen this week. But the whole process of putting out the kind of detailed and, in fact, personalized messages people need to know, culturally sensitive messages, messages that are specific to people who are pregnant or who have other conditions that might make them hesitate. All that needs to be rolled out in a very, very careful education campaign.
Jessica, we talked about how 60% of Americans say they're willing to get the vaccine. What do public health officials need to do to get that number higher?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think a lot of it has to do with trust. There are some communities that feel rightfully distrusting of public health recommendations and just even anything coming out of pharmaceutical companies. And I think we can restore trust by showing people that this was really not about some of the kind of sinister motivations that a lot of people assume about the medical community and even the pharmaceutical community. Right now, because we are in a public health emergency, this was quite honest, and I realize my bias here, one of the most wonderful, collaborative, all hands on deck kind of projects for science and for public health. And I think by reframing the urgency and changing that from, the language about rushing and being in haste, reframing that and showing people that this is really about the public good and for caring for people and to prevent more loss, I think that sentiment change can happen.
Frances, when it comes to messaging from the Trump administration so far about the vaccine, what have we heard?
Well, it's been very confusing, right? We've had a president who has been anti-science, anti-expert through much of his administration, who then becomes the great champion of producing a vaccine. We've had two attempts at pushing out a campaign earlier on. I think it was the end of October. HHS started a campaign that was going to star celebrities, and that sort of fell apart when it was tangled up in the election. So these messages have been politicized. Right now, we're at a moment where it's late getting into this. There's a new HHS campaign rolling out, but it's really crucial that, just as Jessica said, trusted scientific messages come out. There are going to be judgment calls for individuals, but there needs to be clarity. And these trusted messengers that Jessica referred to become very, very important. I was at a flu clinic in Baltimore a few weeks ago where an awful lot has been done. This was in a Latino community, and a lot was being done by enlisting pastors, people who had connections with the community, and helping them they're using their own words, right, but informing pastors who would then inform other people. When people came into the clinic and received their flu vaccination, they went away with flyers to tell their neighbors about where to get the shots. So there's a lot being done in local communities, partly because of a dearth of messaging from on top, but there's a lot being done in local communities to try and foster these trusted messengers and overcome this history, which Jessica was referring to. The big hitch here is we've spent $10 billion, I think, and somebody can correct me on that figure, perhaps, on vaccine development. There is very little money right now for distribution of these vaccines in the states or for the kinds of campaigns we're talking about.
We're going to talk a little bit about more state-by-state efforts in the upcoming segment. But Jessica, is there an effective way for at least the federal government to get this message out about the vaccine now, particularly considering that the White House staffers will be getting, will be some of the first folks, at least what we're hearing, to get the vaccine?
Yeah, I mean, Francis brought up some great points in that, you know, we can lead by example and by, you know, being very precise with words. Every single word when it comes to science and trust in science matters. So even from, you know, a lot of the damage control that's had to be done because of the naming of Operation Warp Speed, that's not lost on us. That those were days lost and minutes lost of having to kind of correct what was presumed from those words. And I think the same thing can happen when we take it not just from the federal government top down, but like Francis said, making it much more lateral from the community. Because at this point, it's not just you know, instilling public trust, it's restoring the trustworthiness of leaders. And I think that even goes to the federal government. There's been a lot of broken or just shattered trustworthiness because we have dealt with so many antagonistic sentiments that have come out of leadership here that have made it so difficult to understand what is politically motivated, what is financially motivated. And so, you know, that messaging has to come, yes, from the top, and hopefully from a new administration, on top of the fact that it needs to be very lateral from a community basis.
Francis, we talked a little bit about what the federal government's messaging so far has been, but what about state governments? Where are they in the process?
They also have been slowed by the fact that, in fact, slowed by the fact that the vaccine came out so quickly. They weren't able to get going early. They've been enormously stretched, hampered by, you know, decades of lack of funding, and now being stretched by the other commitments they've had to responding immediately to vaccines. Now, if you go on YouTube, you can find some individual states have been putting up PSAs and trying to work on this. They're also working very closely with, you know, many state health departments have much smaller local health departments, and they're working with those local departments to try to reach into communities that that specifically need tailored messaging to meet individuals, as I said, where they are. The thing about this whole process is that political campaigns and marketers, right, have known how to reach the swing voter, the person who's on the fence about whether to buy the new iPhone. And we're in a little bit that situation with the coronavirus vaccine. There are probably, you know, we're getting numbers. There are certain people who we absolutely know won't get this vaccine. They've said so very firmly. There are some anti-vaccine people, a rather small proportion of the whole country, who take no vaccines. And then there are people on the other end. We heard from some in your commentary saying, yes, I'm gung-ho, I'll take it right away. But in the middle, there are many people who are hesitant for different reasons, and tailoring, being able to educate them, answer their specific questions, and tailoring messaging to them, just like political campaigns, go for the swing voter, right, is what we need to do with this, is really respect people's concerns. This isn't a question of just gung-ho, go out there and get it. It's listen to, understand people, be empathetic about their concerns, and meet them and explain to them. And that's, I think, how we win them over.
Jessica, beyond government, though, how necessary is it, as you mentioned earlier, to get community leaders involved with the messaging? Is that even more effective than, say, an ad or a public service announcement?
You know, it's part of the puzzle, right? There can't just be one approach to this. It requires several. I mean, in the same way we talk about risk being additive and you can kind of have the image of the Swiss cheese method, you can kind of apply that similarly to public health messaging, right? There is so many ways to reinforce it, and it has to be kind of combined in with other channels and with other messages as well to reinforce that trust. And I think that local messaging, lateral messaging is key. You know, prior to COVID-19, I was working on vaccine communications for several years. And Francis is absolutely right that, you know, the wins, the opportunities are not with the kind of far off conspiracy anti-community. It's really with those who are hesitant, those who are feeling overwhelmed by the absolute deluge of information available to them, having a difficult time to parse through what's fact from fiction. And if we bring that language down, we don't have to dumb it down, but we can make it accessible, judgment-free, and understandable so that it becomes part of people's conversation in barbershops, in restaurants, in or I not restaurants really, but in places where people are going with their community and having those conversations in using language that they understand, it's going to actually change public perception.
We've been talking today about a lot of the images also that we see in messaging around the coronavirus in general and prevention of the virus. And one thing that struck me was that in New York, Sandra Lindsay, who we heard at the very top of the segment of the last segment, is a Black healthcare worker from Queens. She was the first person to get the vaccine in the United States yesterday. My sense was that the optics of having a Black healthcare worker be the first person to take this was potentially also to assuage some of the fears in the Black community about the vaccine. Do you think that that's effective, Jessica?
Absolutely. It was not lost on anybody that it was a Black woman who was administering the vaccine and a Black woman who was receiving the vaccine. I think that was intentional, and I think that was extremely smart. I think that also allowing her the chance to speak and to hear from her as to what she was feeling. I mean, I got choked up when I heard her say healing is coming and that she believes in the science and she wants to instill public trust in this process. That goes a long way. When you have people who are doing it willingly, and here's the thing, the trauma that the Black community has experienced in this country is legitimate. What happened with the Tuskegee experiments, what happened with gynecological experimentation on Black and brown bodies is horrendous. And so that lack of trust is justified. And I think to restore that requires building up Black leaders in the healthcare community, making sure that they have the mic so that they can speak and speak with confidence about what and why they're doing these things. That's going to go a long way with these communities who have had so many years of distrust because of legitimate harm.
Frances, are there certain types of vaccine messaging that might alienate people?
Well, I think if anybody feels bullied or rushed, we're doing the wrong thing. But I, speaking to what Jessica was talking about, all these different levels of messaging add up together. And the fact that Dr. Fauci has said he'll have his shot on TV or on camera, at least. And three presidents we know about, Obama, Clinton, and Bush, have all said they will do that. These are messages from on high that also have an impact. And we heard that from some of your listeners. Dr. Fauci is going to do it. I'll do it. So where people find their trust messengers will be different for different communities. I talked to researchers in the Navajo Nation, which, as you know, has been incredibly hard hit. They've done some very good centralized messaging in that nation, but the wording of the messages there can so CDC messages over maternity health and previous campaigns that I wrote about had the CDC messages to many other people had been, are you pregnant? They were very direct messages addressed to people. And in the Navajo Nation, many people down there felt more comfortable with a message that said, for all women who are pregnant, this is the advice. In other words, a more inclusive message was more, they responded to better. So every word matters, and every word matters in different communities.
Frances, do you see, you mentioned the funding here for these types of messages. Is there any will or funding to actually create these public service announcements right now?
I think there's will, certainly at the local level and the state level, is an enormous push for, and you saw that debate coming up over the weekend about the amount of money that had been spent on developing these vaccines. There's a sort of truism in public health. Vaccines don't save lives. Vaccination does. That's where we are now. We've put $10 billion into the vaccines. We need to put equivalent amounts of money into a sort of Operation Warp Speed for messaging right now, as one doctor in Boston put it to me.
Jessica, we've got about a minute left. Would you concur?
Absolutely. I know exactly the piece from the Saad Omar piece that he wrote. You know, this is an unprecedented vaccination campaign that the U.S. hasn't seen in any of our lifetimes. And right now, we need to be putting the same kind of resources and concentration on the messaging about it, because if we have vaccines in vials and not in people, it gets us nowhere.
Frances Steed Sellers is a health reporter at The Washington Post, and Jessica Malati Rivera is the science communication lead at the COVID Tracking Project and an infectious disease epidemiologist. Thanks to you both for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thank you.
OK,
Okay, everybody, we're done for today, but it was great to have you with us. And we're watching a lot of different stories this week with so much happening. If you want to suggest a story to us, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. And we'll be listening. Also, go check out our podcast. If you missed anything or you want to listen back, it's at thetakeaway.org or iTunes or anywhere you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.